Hi, welcome to episode 2 of Jane Austentations, the podcast where we watch and review every single Jane Austen adaptation ever filmed, and we do that very slowly. I am Sasha Sienna. I am a writer and performer who is just wild for Jane Austen, and I'm with Jessica Law. Jess, who are you?
I am a bird journalist, and I also a costume pedant, and I also know a little bit about history as well. I've worked in a lot of historical museums.
And we are going to be talking about the 2005 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice today. Jess, is this your first experience with Pride and Prejudice?
I think it's my first experience of actually sitting down and fully concentrating on a Pride and Prejudice adaptation. But it did kind of feel a little bit sort of familiar. So I think Pride and Prejudice is such an iconic thing. It's entered into the public consciousness. So I did feel some of the things were slightly familiar and I'd heard them talked about or referenced before.
Yeah, in the same way that you can recognise that a particular character is from a Star Wars, even if you don't know what their name is. Or
yes, like the Slug Frog Man.
Like the Slug Frog Man. For listeners, Jess means Jabba the Hutt.
He's my favourite. He looks so cheery.
So you had that kind of level of understanding of Pride and Prejudice?
Yeah.
Okay, and how did you find the film?
Overall, it felt a bit rushed. So I could kind of keep up with what was going on, like partly because of the cultural consciousness and references and stuff. And there certainly wasn't a situation like last time where like a man jumped in through the window and then was just in the whole film. I could keep up with what was going on, but it seemed as if you could really tell that it had been cut down from something longer. I thought a lot of the characters, there wasn't enough time to establish what their character was like. And if you'd have spent a little longer establishing what their characters were like, it would have explained some of the wacky stuff that they did later.
That's really interesting because one of the things that I think this film does well is I think a lot of the characters are really well introduced. I think that especially the side characters, like, you know, Lydia is just, you know, Lydia as soon as she gets on screen, I feel like, and Mr. and Mrs. Bennet as well.
Yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Bennet were good. I mean, maybe if you've read it, you love the way the character played.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm coming at it already knowing these characters so well.
I didn't get to know them very well, and it would have been better to know their motivations and their little ways. And I think there were times where I felt as if they could have focused on the plot or the characters a bit more, but actually they were just filming some people walking in a field or like a bit of a house. Maybe they could have tried to include less, but do it better.
So you would rather have them cut out more artistic shot to focus more on the meat of the plot?
I felt as if something needed to be done because I just, some of the things that happened were just really surprising because I hadn't got to know those characters and why they did the things.
I wanted to come back to it. You said you described some of the things that the characters did as wacky.
Oh, yeah.
I am fascinated to know what you think is wacky in this film.
Well, it's actually got some topics that are sort of quite raunchy, like, and not what you'd expect from the sort of the stereotype of Jane Austen, of sort of very, you know, staid and prim and proper comedy of manners.
Which bits did you find raunchy?
Well, there's an unsuitable elopement where they probably had extramarital sex. Oh, no.
Oh, my goodness, Jess. They've actually tidied up Wickham's character, like they've cleaned him up a little, so he's actually less of a cad in this one than he is in the book.
I mean, he did like seduce Darcy's teenaged underage sister.
Yeah, no, but in the book he does that and he plans an elopement with her and she consents to an elopement, so it's questionable whether something happened there more than a plan.
It does make the plot more interesting. It's just before you're familiar with them, you have this idea of what it's like, and then you discover it and you're pleasantly surprised. Like, Jane Austen is a lot funnier than I thought she was going to be, and also a lot, a lot raunchier. And there's this one bit where the vicar is giving a speech, the awful vicar.
Oh, Mr. Collins.
Yes, and he accidentally says intercourse with, instead of like the intercourse between so-and-so and so-and-so, like he accidentally says intercourse with, and then gets all embarrassed.
I love that bit. Well,
is that in the book?
No, it's not. Oh. Or at least I don't remember it. And I know that if he does make that mistake, he makes it somewhere else, not while giving a sermon, because you don't really see him giving a sermon. But when he says that, the camera like pans to Charlotte Lucas's face. Well, Charlotte Collins by then, her face. And she looks like really pleased about it in a way that made me just go, ugh.
There's another bit where, so weird, the dad is leading a pig into the house.
And the lingering shot on the pig's balls.
Yeah, and then the mom does this sort of approving glance. What does it mean? It's so worrying.
It's so bizarre.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, they do wacky things, and like, maybe we'll talk about Darcy afterwards, but like, it's like he undergoes a complete personality change from standoffish and taciturn to kind and caring. And it's almost like in a pantomime, where at the end of the pantomime, the fairy waves the wand and she's just like, right, you're good now, which it was a bit abrupt.
I agree. I think one of my biggest issues with this film is that change is so abrupt. It feels very rushed over, and I think that one of the real joys of the original work and of some other adaptations that we'll watch in future episodes is seeing that gradual change.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, I think, that they rush over this one so quickly.
Really weird. And also, in pantomimes, it just makes me think, what's the point of the entire plot of the pantomime if the fairy could have just waved the wand and done that right from the start?
Could Lizzie not have just, in the first scene, told Darcy, hey, you're a bit of a dick, and then, woohoo, he's good now, he's a chill, friendly guy. Obviously, that is a massive, massive oversimplification. Please don't write angry letters to us saying that we don't understand Darcy or anything.
Brilliant.
So while we're talking about Darcy, and while we've kind of been talking about the raunchy bits of Jane Austen,
yeah,
one thing I think this film does really well is Darcy seems so horny all the time. Like, he is longing for Keira Knightley's Elizabeth the whole way through.
Really?
Don't you think?
No, I think he constantly looks like he's just been told his pet guinea pig has died. Like, I honestly think that between each scene, they bought him a new pet guinea pig and then just strangled it in front of his eyes in order to make him look like that. It's just bizarre. He's so rude, and he's not doing any acting at all at the start. He's very wooden.
I agree, he's very wooden at the start. I think he's almost like playing two different characters, one in the first half of the film and one in the second half of the film. And I think he's much better at playing the second half.
Yeah, I think, I don't know who the actor is, but it's probably more like what the actor's really like in the second half.
I don't know Matthew McFadden personally.
But more people are like the second half than they are the first half.
What was your favourite thing about this film?
I mean, it was very funny. I liked the awful vicar. The awful vicar was great, and the mum and dad were great. You know, the backup characters they stole the show.
They so often do. What do you think of Elizabeth Bennet?
I thought she was very nice. She often seemed the only sane one in the whole thing. She seemed very kind, a lot more likeable than Emma, definitely. Yeah, but she didn't seem particularly edgy or exciting, like there wasn't a particular thing. She did make some very witty comments at certain points, but not as many as I would have liked.
I'm interested to see what you think of other interpretations of her.
Well, it's just sort of, she's made out to be this sort of down-to-earth character who doesn't know how to sing well or paint or anything like that, but she tells it how it is, and she sort of makes some cutting remarks, and it would have been nice to see a bit more of that.
Perhaps that's one of the things that they had to cut to fit everything in. Because it is obviously, it's 2 hours long, which is a plenty long for a film, but it's not a huge amount of time to get all of Pride and Prejudice on screen.
Yeah, I think maybe I'm blaming them too much for not fitting it in. It was probably a huge challenge.
Well, I've yet to see a feature-length version of Pride and Prejudice, so like a single film's version of Pride and Prejudice that tries to stay faithful to the book and still doesn't make the story seem rushed.
Yeah. Interesting.
I think this one does rush some things, but it's definitely not the worst that I've seen. When I first saw this film, I didn't like it.
Ah, why?
I think largely that was because I love the 1995 adaptation.
Ah, so you'd been spoiled.
I'd been spoiled, and also because and this is my problem, I don't like Keira Knightley. I don't know why. I think she's a very good actress. She's great. I've seen her be so good in some things, and I'm aware it's not her fault that I don't like her. I think I don't like her because the first thing I saw her in, or the first two things I saw her in, were Pirates of the Caribbean, where she's just nothing-y. She's just the woman there.
Bit of a plank of wood.
She doesn't pass the sexy lamp test, which...
Oh, yeah.
So it's Kelly Sue DeConnick's kind of test, where if you replace a woman in your plot with a sexy lamp and it still works, then that's bad. And I think that the plot of Pirates of the Caribbean still works if you replace Elizabeth, whatever her name is, with a sexy lamp. And her entire character can be summed up as, she is a woman, but also does not like corsets. What?
Oh my giddy aunt! I'm so unbelievably shocked by that.
And then the other thing that I first saw her in was Bend It Like Beckham. And I hate her character in that. She's a dreadful friend.
Yeah, quite a cold character in that, yeah. I don't know, I think I'd give her the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I know, and I'm working on it. And I've seen this film quite a lot of times. I've lost count, even though I didn't like it the first time. And honestly, every time I watch it, I like it more. There's definitely, I think, a lot to like about it.
I think in choosing the actor for Elizabeth Bennet, they definitely went by the standards of nowadays rather than the beauty standards of the Regency era. Because, I mean, I'm not saying that she's not attractive, but they would not have found her attractive in the Regency era.
No, she's not the idealised Regency face.
I mean, they wouldn't have found me attractive in the Regency era, like, so, you know, I'm allowed to say it. But, like, they would have thought she looked ill, they would have thought she looked poor and haggard, and that sort of thing, and but yeah, they definitely chose the standards of the times nowadays.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that for me, where this falls down is that it's a bit too Hollywood.
Yeah.
They've leaned a little too much into making a film for Americans' idea of Jane Austen. And not just Americans, but I think there is a difference in the fandom in America versus in England.
Oh, interesting. What are the main differences?
Well, part of the difference is obviously that in England, there's no Anglophilia in the Jane... Well, sometimes there is, you know, but...
we certainly don't idealise ourselves quite as
exactly,
much.
Exactly, yeah. In America, so much of the Jane Austen culture there is tied up in a love of England as it's presented in Jane Austen. Whereas for us, I think when we look at it, I mean, and again, there are people who read Jane Austen and talk about Jane Austen in England who do see this as idealised version of our country. They definitely exist, but I think that that's a much lower part of it, a much lesser part of it. And I think that there's a tendency to draw out and exaggerate in American facing adaptations, whereas I think that the way that British people tend to relate to Jane Austen is so often in that subtlety.
Yeah, definitely.
Which I think is not focused on here. They don't really play to that. They don't really try and do anything understated. They want to take what's there and pull it out and magnify it. So, like, just look at the difference between Longbourn and Pemberley in this adaptation.
Yes, I was going to ask about that. So they literally live in a farm.
Yeah.
And it would, is that in the book? And then when they go to visit Darcy's house, and also, can you just wander into someone's house when they're not there? That they just let them in. That sounds very strange. And it's basically Buckingham Palace. Like, was that in the book?
So, some of it yes and some of it no. There isn't a really detailed description of Longbourn, where the Bennets live, in the book. Because at the time there wouldn't really need to have been. Everybody would just be so familiar with that kind of house. But the Bennets are not farmers. They definitely wouldn't have had pigs running through their kitchen. they lived in a gentleman's seat, which had an estate attached. And the estate would have brought in, kind of, obviously, turning Regency money into modern era money is incredibly iffy and squashy, and it's a bit of a mess because labour was so cheap but fabric was so expensive and it doesn't really track. But the Longbourn estate, hang on a second, I'm just gonna get my little converter up. So the Longbourn estate is supposed to bring in about £2,000 a year, which by roughly modern standards is about 60 grand.
Yeah, so definitely no pigs in the living room.
So no pigs in the kitchen. They would have been letting to farmers, but they would not have been farming themselves. Their income, they are gentry. Their income is passive. They don't work for it. They may well have had some chickens in their garden, you know, but they wouldn't have been the ones chasing the pig through the kitchen, for sure.
They'd be leisure chickens.
Yeah, they might be leisure chickens, or their kitchen staff might have been the ones actually looking after the chickens.
Yeah, because they're very, very much portrayed as peasants in this.
They are, absolutely. The way that they dress, the way that their house is so faded. Like, it's so, so over the top.
It's almost like a pantomime, and I have so much to say about the way that they dress, but that's a rant for perhaps the Austenly vibe section. I recognised Pemberley from the talk that we went to at the Jane Austen Festival last year.
Oh yes, when I dragged you to the Jane Austen Festival.
And I had no idea what was going on. But I made us both costumes, so that's all right.
You did. They looked amazing.
She was a historical architect. I've forgotten her name now, unfortunately. But she was showing how basically completely unrealistic the places were in films compared to in the books. And
to be fair, sometimes she was saying how realistic they were. She had good and bad examples.
Yeah, that's true, but this film, Darcy's House, was a bad example. I remember her showing that exact building and saying, like, this is an example of them really sort of overblowing how...
I think you might be thinking of Rosings, which is Lady Catherine's house, because the interesting thing about the Pemberley in this one...
Oh, maybe I am.
The Chatsworth House, which is the exterior. I don't know much about the house that it was used for the interior filming, but Chatsworth House is actually the exact house that it was suggested was the real life inspiration for Pemberley.
Oh wow, really? Oh, I stand corrected.
It's in a very similar location and it matches the descriptions really well. And at the time, some readers suggested that it was the basis for Pemberley when Jane Austen was writing it.
Oh, that's a really nice touch.
I know, I really liked that. I thought that was a really nice touch as well. You're absolutely right. The Bennet's poverty is really blown up. But do you want to talk about Rosings, Lady Catherine's house?
Yeah, so I think that must have been the one in the talk where she's saying, like, this is just completely overblown. It was was, I mean, was it actually Buckingham Palace?
I know, it was huge, wasn't it? I think it's actually bigger than Buckingham Palace.
I think it was bigger than Buckingham Palace. And, I mean, I know she's meant to be super rich and supercilious, but it's a bit much.
I'm just doing some research into Burghley House, which is actually where it was filmed.
Oh, really? Oh, I've been to Burghley House twice.
Have you?
It's amazing. So it's a Tudor house, and King Henry VIII actually stayed there at one point when he was travelling around the country. I don't know why. I think maybe Tudor kings went on tour or something, because loads of Tudor-era houses say, like, oh, King Henry VIII stayed here and stuff like that. And it's got, the beds are really interesting because they're just not like modern beds at all. They're really tall and you have to have some steps to get into them. And in one of the rooms, the steps actually had like a porta potty in
what,
the steps.
In the stairs?
Like a chamber pot, yeah, in the little steps to get to the bed. And I think people had very different ideas about the position that you sleep in those days, because the bed seemed almost as if you'd be sleeping in a semi-upright position, like you'd be sitting up. I don't know whether that was just the way they looked.
Huh.
But yeah, and another interesting thing about it was that there weren't actually any corridors, or there weren't many corridors, and a lot of really old houses, it was mainly true of medieval houses, but maybe Tudor houses had this as well. They hadn't actually invented corridors yet. And the reason they had those four-poster beds with the curtains all around them was to have some privacy, because in order to get to your bedroom, you had to just walk through a load of other people's bedrooms. And they could be sleeping, they could be doing other things.
Do you know, I've noticed this when I've been to other houses, you know, big stately houses, and I have always wondered what's up with that, and now I know.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the, oh my gosh, you've got to, oh, maybe one day we could go together, because it's in Stamford, which is in the East Midlands, but it's actually a really short train journey away from Cambridge and London. We should go and do like a little video or something for all our millions of followers that we'll have by that point. And the staircase is the highlight. So the staircase is painted to look like the descent into hell.
Oh my goodness, why?
I don't know. They just went off on, they decided to get creative.
That sounds fun.
It is, the stairwell is the doorway into hell. And the doorway into hell is a giant cat's mouth.
Amazing.
And I actually think that's where Charles Dodgson, Lewis Carroll, got his idea for the Cheshire Cat, because it looks just like the Cheshire Cat. And you've got all the sinners, like, going down into hell and stuff like that, like, representing the seven deadly sins. And a lot of the ceilings are painted with these paintings. Burghley House is just a really, really fun trip.
I really want to go.
It's ridiculously over the top. Unbelievable.
I tell you what, this film really made me want to do three things. One, play the piano. Two, go to the Peak District.
Oh, yes.
And three, have a long, pining love affair. But unfortunately, I am trapped inside and already married. So,
oh, how inconvenient.
Only playing the piano is available to me. Well, playing the keyboard is available to me.
I must admit, it made me heartsick for the countryside.
Me too.
What it made me want to do was go and visit a lot of historical properties and just skip around in the beautiful countryside and maybe go to the seaside.
Oh, to get back to your question about would people just go to other people's houses? Yes, they totally would have. Yes. So the same way that we might go to a National Trust house now, and in fact have done, you would basically do that, but the family would still be living there. So the family wouldn't live in all of the rooms. You know, for a huge house like Pemberley, they would live in a part of the house, and then the fanciest rooms would be open to the public. And then they might use them if they were having like a ball, you know, or company. But for every day, they'd just be in the more comfortable rooms, which are probably generally smaller, but easier to heat, that sort of thing.
See, so it kind of, that's probably where they got the idea for the National Trust in the first place.
Well, a lot of those houses were basically being kept as they are now, but by the families that owned them. And the National Trust started taking them over when those families could no longer afford to keep them.
I see. There's another really weird thing, which I don't know whether they actually did, is like, did friends just go round to each other's houses and just stay there for months?
Well, sort of, yeah.
Because I think it's Bingley turns up and he's like, oh, yes. Or Darcy says, oh, yes, I'm staying at Bingley's house for the next 3 months.
Yeah, no, they would.
Then they get a bit tired of them. Is it a kind of a holiday, or do they just...
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you can't just take a day trip to see your friends that live in other part of the country, so you maintain friendships by spending a lot of time together.
Yeah, that's true. It would take you days to get from.
Exactly. If you're going to spend... So Lizzie goes to stay with Mr. Collins and Charlotte Lucas. She goes to stay with them in Kent for about 5 weeks, I think. And it's going to take her a few days to get there, so yeah, of course you're going to stay there for a while.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds like the life of Riley. So I've always had this sense of I don't understand why I have this, because I'm from a working class background. You know, I've always been very poor. But for some reason, I feel as if everybody should treat me like I'm a Victorian aristocrat or like a Regency aristocrat.
You know, I feel like everyone should treat you like a Victorian aristocrat as well.
Yeah, like, I honestly feel as if I should spend most of my days reading, sewing, playing on the piano and just languishing on chaise longues.
While people bring you tea.
Yeah, I honestly have had this sense of injustice my entire life that I'm not maintained in such a lifestyle. And I don't know where it's come from, because never have I ever had any sort of sense of entitlement drummed into me. And yet, I just feel, you know, this is the way that I feel as if I should be kept.
I would love for you to be kept in that manner.
Yeah, me too.
This is a gorgeous film, though, I think, while we're talking about the locations and the countryside and how much we want to go to them.
The locations were so much better than the last one. Like, there were no enormous swamps or vast tracts of bare earth in this one.
I think it's just beautiful. The countryside in it is gorgeous. The cinematography is beautiful. The light is amazing. The music is lovely. Like, it's just an aesthetic delight.
It's like going on holiday. Well, in some ways it's an aesthetic delight. The costumes were not beautiful.
Oh, some of them were pretty.
Oh, dear God. So the first impression that I got of it was that it was like a school play. It was like, you know, in your like secondary school production of, I don't know, Oliver Twist, where everybody just grabs what they've got in their wardrobes and it's this mishmash and...
Whatever you've got that's misshapen and brown.
Yeah, it's like, it's not necessarily, like, exactly right, but it kind of will do. That's how it felt. And I know that the Bennets are meant to be less wealthy than the rest of them, but Elizabeth Bennet would absolutely not wear a dress that looks like some sort of baggy Hessian sack. That's just not something that, even if you did live in a farm, you'd want to look respectable. And as I was saying last time, you'd want to look more wealthy and more impressive than you are. And she seems to be doing the very opposite. And there was a very strange thing with the dresses. So So you know how the Empire waistline is very high up? It's like basically under your bust.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is floaty and diaphanous. So all of the Bennet sisters, for some reason them, and basically only them, had this slightly lower waistline. So it was a sort of a horizontal waistline, like the Regency style, but it was slightly lower. And
what, like at the natural waist rather than...
Yeah, kind of at or just above the natural waist. And I don't understand why they would have that, because I know that... I think what they were kind of trying to do is saying that because they're less wealthy, they're going to be dressing in more of the old-fashioned sort of Georgian style.
But how old are their clothes then? Older than they are?
Well, exactly. And certainly the parents, yeah, that's absolutely fine. They can dress in the Georgian style, and they do. And that is probably authentic. You would have kept your clothes for years, or you would have kept your traditions of when you'd be stuck in your ways of dressing. But the daughters, yeah, how old are those clothes? Because people would have, when this book was written, people would have been wearing the Empire waistline for at least a decade. And not only that, but if it is true that the sisters were dressing in the old-fashioned Georgian style, that's not what that looks like. Like, if they did dress Georgian, then the skirts would be wider, fuller, and perhaps the waistline might be
a lot more like Mrs. Bennet's dresses.
Yes, exactly. Yes, the waistline might be V-shaped or something like that. So when they were at the first ball that they went to, I understand that that was meant to be where the wealthy and the poor were mixing. There were lots of different backgrounds, but it honestly just looked like a school play. And even the younger people were wearing like Georgian style things. Some of the older people were wearing Regency style things, and it was just this mishmash, like regardless of age or apparent background, just this horrible mishmash of different things.
I did notice the lower waistline on Lizzie, and certainly the fact that they keep putting her in brown colours, and I had kind of noticed it on Lizzie and thought, well, that's how they're showing that she's not like other girls. You know, that's how they're showing that she's different.
Yeah.
It didn't work for me.
No, it didn't work for me either. I think if they'd have kept the colours, but they'd have had, the Regency shape. Because you've got this bust, it's basically the kind of stays that you wear, basically like a push-up bra, and it's got this shelf effect where your boobs are basically up around your neck.
Oh, that reminds me. I wanted to ask you about the underwear. So there's quite a long scene where we see them all getting ready for the ball at Netherfield, and all the sisters are in their underwear. And I was wondering if you had any insights.
So it looks a bit Georgian, but it's certainly better than some historical adaptations. It's good that they're wearing shifts underneath their stays, which they would have done, just to stop the stays from poking into them. By stays, I mean the old-fashioned style of corset. It would stop the stays from poking into them, and it would stop it from rubbing and hurting. So that's correct. And a lot of these things don't do that, because they kind of want to give the impression like, oh, corsets were bad, they really hurt women, and they left these painful marks on them, and like the directors deliberately want to show that. But that, I think that certainly is not as bad as it could be.
I really like, it's quite a small thing, but in that scene where Jane and Lizzie are getting ready together and they're doing each other's hair, I thought that the hairstyles that they did for both of them were just beautiful, just really nice, actually. They seem, to my mind, to be fairly accurate, but in a way that's actually nice.
Yeah, good compromise, yeah.
Yeah, good compromise.
They chose the nice, it's like they chose the nice styles of the time, and not the unflattering ones, which they could have done with some of the other things. So I've seen a video of this historical costumier sort of putting it on. Not like, nothing indecent, it's all like completely decent. But anyway, so because of this shelf effect where you had to have like this really push-up bra effect, if you were to just put it on like a normal corset, the cups would be like by your neck and just nowhere near your boobs at all. So to put it on, you either had to put it on as normal and then like scoop your boobs up into the top half so they're like flattened and pushed up. Another thing that you could do is if you like bend upside down and then put it on, like it seemed like they were the only ways that you could even have this.
I'm not sure I could scoop my boobs up that far. I think I'd have to do bending over.
Very weird. And I would just be disqualified for not having any sort of shelf effect at all. Just to note that although their dresses do look very flowing and diaphanous, women did wear stays because they were like a support garment, like a bra. And in fact, it probably would have been more uncomfortable not to wear them in some ways. And they didn't have them like tight laced, like, because you wouldn't be able to go about your daily duties. Like, there's this idea that corsets and stays were these horrible torture devices. But that was only really for a very handful of high fashion victims. and everyone else, it would be a support garment and it would have some effects, but you wouldn't be fighting for breath or anything, because a lot of women had to do physical activity. So they're certainly not as evil and torturous as people think. They were basically like wearing a bra.
So we talked about how Keira Knightley doesn't have the like a Regency look, but you know who I think is really well cast is Rosamund Pike.
Ah, the sister.
Yeah, Jane. I think she's brilliant in the role. I think her performance is fantastic. But what I think is really nice as a bonus is that she's someone who's just so beautiful by both today's standards and Regency standards.
Yeah, I think they definitely made a good choice there. And I feel as if I would have liked more time to get to know her. Because when Elizabeth says at the end to Mr. Darcy, oh, she didn't, what's his name? She didn't not like Bingley, she's just shy. But then, like, I would have liked more time to get to know that she was shy in order for it to make sense. But yeah, she was really, really good, really well acted.
Shall we go on to our scoring then?
Yes, let's.
Okay, so let's start with the side characters, since we're already talking about it. Are they compelling? Yes. Are they believable? Are the performances good? And do they feel like an excellent satire of people who may have lived 300 years ago?
I was really impressed by them. I absolutely thought that they were that awful vicar. Oh, he was a hoot.
Oh, he's so good. You know, I have never seen a performance of Mr. Collins that I didn't rate as one of the best performances in the film.
It's such a good part to play. He was so embarrassing. And when he brought Lizzie the world's smallest flower to propose to her.
Oh, whole proposal scene was just so, so painful to watch in a very enjoyable way.
I really like the way Lizzie got really impatient with him.
Yes.
Because he's just like, oh, I understand you need time to decide. And she's like, no, I don't. I'm genuinely saying I don't want to marry him.
I really enjoyed watching Keira Knightley's face as he went through the speech and seeing all the bits where she's like holding in laughter and where she's looking like she's got this what mate look on her face that sometimes just subtly, I think it's really lovely. And I really like the way that they've included this little bit where she's mouthing at her family like, no, don't leave me alone with him.
Oh, yes, they all had to go out. Oh.
And they all have to go and leave her to hear this horrible proposal.
So embarrassing.
Yeah, it's awful. I think there's a scene. So the scene in the Netherfield Ball where Lizzie and Darcy.
Is the Netherfield Ball the posh ball?
The posh ball, yeah. It's where Lizzie and Darcy are dancing together. Then the room disappears, you know, everybody else in the room disappears. It's like they're dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that bit is a really beloved bit of the film, but I think it is nowhere near as well executed as the conversation right before, the sequence right before it, where Lizzie and Mr. Collins are dancing and Jane is also dancing in a different next to them. And Jane is trying to tell Lizzie about why Mr. Wickham's not there, and Lizzie's trying to hear what Jane has to say, and Mr. Collins is trying to tell Lizzie how much he wants to spend the evening hanging around her and paying her these elegant little compliments, and it's
that
so...
That he prepares in advance.
I just think that whole sequence where they're shuffling around the dance floor and swapping positions, and it's just so well done.
Very clever.
It's so good.
Oh, he's just awful. He did raise an interesting thought that I had, which was both in Emma and in this, it seems like Jane Austen's not afraid to criticise men at all.
Oh, definitely not.
And she lays into men just as much, if not more so, than the women in the stories. Do you know if she got a lot of criticism for that at the time? Or did men just not read the books? Or did they not mind? Or
do you know, I don't know if she got a lot of criticism.
Did mainly women read her books, or was it...
Well, it wasn't just women. Certainly some men read them. Mark Twain hated them, so he did read them. But the stereotype at the time was that novels were read by young women, and they were very, very frivolous. They weren't only read by young women, but that was the stereotype.
Well, I just felt as if, like, it's probably really relatable to a lot of young women reading it at the time, and perhaps it was a way to sort of gently make fun of men behind their backs to other women.
Well, I don't want to be one of these Jane Austen fans that attaches motivations to her that we just can't know, but I feel like she was writing for women primarily. Like, writing to other women.
You're meant to write for your oldest target audience member, aren't you?
Are you?
Yeah. So in young adult fiction, for example, and children's fiction, you have the age of the main character as the oldest target audience member for
right,
that age
that's
range.
Interesting.
So if it's a young adult novel, you might make the character, I don't know, 17, 18, I'm not sure, but something like that, where, like, it's the oldest person who might feasibly read that book.
Oh, I don't think that was considered, like, a bastion of novel publishing at the dawn of the novel, but...
Oh, no, probably not.
Yeah, but that certainly doesn't mean that it's not something that she would have been thinking about, you know.
With the plain friend, Charlotte, you know, she was perfectly good and that bit... Not particularly interesting, but it just made me feel really bad for the actor, because it's very clear that in the plot she is described as being plain. And then what's it like for the actors who get deliberately hired to be plain?
I always wonder that.
Like, because when you deliberately hire older actors to play older people, that's fair enough, because you know that...
You know what age
old.
You are.
Yeah, you know what age you are. But, like, I always wonder whether they're just like, oh, well, I'm perfectly confident. I'm happy with the way I look. A job's a job. Or whether it actually makes them feel, you know, quite like, oh, my God, I got hired deliberate because I am, like, definitely plain.
I think that for a lot of actors, when you look at them and they've been hired because they're plain, and then you look at them, you're like, oh, you don't actually look like that. Like, you've been made up to look plain. And so I wonder like whether the actors are kind of comfortable being also saying, oh no, like, they've made me up to look plain, that's why I look plain right now.
Yeah, I mean, she certainly does, like, have unflattering clothes, no makeup, but not many of the characters wear makeup, and it's kind of like...
No, but there's not many of the characters wear obvious makeup, and there's a professional makeup artist has worked on you to make you look pretty versus a professional makeup artist has worked on you to make you look drab.
Yeah, that is very true. But I'm sure there are some people that are just not as good looking as the star. And
yeah.
I don't know. I'd be, you know, I'd be okay with that. I spent my entire, like, theatrical career, in inverted commas, I was always cast as the granny. I don't think they realised that I could take my glasses off in order to perform. but yeah, never the ingenue. And I certainly know that I look a bit... I'm not sort of the main character material. I'm more like a villain.
To be fair, Jess, I have seen the glasses that you chose to wear at that time. And they were very much advertising, cast me as the granny in your play.
Yeah, but they were deliberately frumpy. Oh, but anyway, like, I'm fine with that because you get to play more interesting people, so it's fine.
What about Lady Catherine de Bourgh?
Oh, so imperial. Oh, so horrible and supercilious. Yeah, she was really good. And by the way, her invalid daughter.
Yeah.
Was so stylish. Like, her and Mary were the only ones who were stylish in the whole thing. Like, Mary was like a proper goth, which I respect. And this invalid daughter, she looked like some sort of steampunk heroine with her little glasses and like black little capelet thing. She just looked really cool.
Yeah, I absolutely love the way they've done Anne de Bourgh. She's a treat.
But yeah, Dame Judi Dench, yeah.
Oh, she's amazing. And I love how when they introduce her, they do this like camera pan that basically works as this slow reveal. And at the end of it, what they're revealing is, yeah, we got Dame motherfucking Judi Dench.
Brilliant.
It's just like they're so proud of this casting. Rightly so, because it's just such a good bit of casting. It's like, who are you going to get to play Lady Catherine de Bourgh? Of course you get Judi Dench. So I really enjoyed that they were so proud of it.
Yeah, she was great. And Mary was great.
Yeah, I really like Mary as well. There's one thing that I noticed on this rewatch. So one thing I think that this adaptation does really, really well is watching characters who aren't speaking react to the character that is speaking.
Oh, yes, so much so.
When Lady Catherine's talking about the piano, she's talking to Lizzie, telling her to play the piano. And she says, there are a few people who understand music as well as I do. And you can just see Darcy's face in the background giving her this like look like, I'm sorry, what? What? Like, just so confused. And then, of course, she says, if I had learned, I would have been a great proficient.
Oh, it's just so good, digging herself into that hole. There was another weird look, which I was intrigued by, which was when the family find out that Mr. Collins has finally got married, they sort of, and they don't quite zoom in on Mary, but they just show her looking really disappointed.
Yes, I was hoping you'd pick up on that. Yeah, so it's not explicitly stated. Yeah, the common consensus is that Mary would totally have married Mr. Collins.
Oh, so that was in the book.
Like, she was right there, you know? And he doesn't notice.
Oh, that's...
But she totally would have married him.
Yeah, I definitely picked up on that. So Mary seems like the kind of teenager I was.
Oh, would you have married Mr. Collins, Jess?
I hope not. But that sort of overly earnest, somber, like taking themselves too seriously, but making themselves look like a complete fool in doing so. Like when she was playing really miserable piano at that party and then her dad had to ask her to stop. Like that is definitely something I would have done because I would have been so awkward about it while also wanting to show off. Like that was all my teenaged years.
Yeah, Mary is absolutely great in this one.
So good.
All the Bennet family are just so good. You mentioned that little zoom onto Mary. And look, it doesn't happen pretty much anywhere else in the film, but why on earth do they do this almost comical zoom onto Darcy's face when he comes? So when Darcy comes into I've forgotten the name of the parsonage, but when he comes into the Collins house to see Lizzie sitting there, and he does that whole like, oh, I'm here, oh, I'm going away now, bye.
Oh, I've come back again in my shirt.
He comes in and then the camera does this like comical zoom onto his face, like it's some sort of daytime murder show.
Oh, that's so funny.
I've never been able to see it without laughing at that. That's,
isn't he meant to, like, jump in a river or something? Am I getting that mixed
up
with something else?
No, you're getting it mixed up. That is, so there's a scene in the 1995 adaptation where Colin Firth does jump in a lake. It's totally added in for horny reasons. But it is very famous. It's very successful.
Because all I remember in this one is just he comes back, but he's just in his shirt and he's a bit damp. Like maybe it was raining or something. I'm not sure about that.
Well, he comes back to give... Do you mean to deliver the letter?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that would have been after after the proposal, when it was raining very hard, to be fair. Yeah. I think we've talked quite well about the side characters. What would you rate it?
Oh, side characters. Oh, I'd give it a strong 8 out of 10.
A strong 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I wasn't like rolling on the floor laughing, but I did really appreciate everyone's performance.
I would also give it a strong 8 out of 10. I toyed with a 9, but then I was like, you've got to have somewhere to go. And there is somewhere to go from this.
Oh, okay. Know? Oh, interesting.
So, I think solid 8 out of 10.
Yeah, definitely.
So, how much did you like Keira Knightley's Lizzie?
I thought she was fine. I would have, as I said, liked to have seen more.
Well, that's faint praise.
Oh, not from me. Unless you haven't already realised by now, I'm very quick to criticise and very slow to praise. Just because it's more fun that way. Like, don't take anything from it. But yeah, I thought she was nice. Sympathetic. I think I would have liked to have seen a bit more cutting wit, because it's very obviously that she's meant to be a really clever, like, she's meant to be the most intelligent one out of all of them, and it would have been nice to have seen a bit more of that.
Yeah, I think maybe in some ways her dad can match her, like, certainly in terms of wittiness her dad can match her, and probably in sense Darcy can match her, but yeah
I love the bit where he said if you don't agree to marry Mr. Collins, your mother will never talk to you, but if you do agree, I'll never talk to you. So good.
I love that bit. Such a good line.
They sort of had a sort of a duo, didn't they, of being both the only sane people in the whole thing.
Yes. Yeah.
What did you think of her?
I like her. It did take me a few rewatches to get over my dislike of Keira Knightley and to remember that she is not actually her character from Bend It Like Beckham. I think she does it well. So one thing that I really love about this film is the lingering looks that they do. They really pay attention to the very small moments that mean so much. You know, the story in Jane Austen is so often in a look or a phrase or just these like tiny moments that make up our whole lives. And I think that this film does a great job of zooming in on that. I think there are quite a few beats where they zoom in on Lizzie and I'm like, what? She seems more sad than I want her to be.
Aww.
And that doesn't mean that she's not likeable. She is. But perhaps Keira Knightley's Lizzie is a little more serious than the Lizzie in my heart.
Ah, okay, interesting.
And so for that reason, I wouldn't give her a 10 out of 10. Not necessarily because she doesn't do a good job, and not because Lizzie Bennet is not a brilliant character, but because for my subjective watching of the film, it loses just a point or two because it's not my Lizzie Bennet I'm watching. It's not quite my Lizzie Bennet.
Well, this whole thing's completely subjective,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, God, I hope nobody's taking what I say seriously. But yeah, do you think that Lizzie Bennet is a Mary Sue? Like, is she Jane Austen putting herself into the story as a hero? Because Jane Austen was meant to be really witty, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think that certainly... there probably is a lot of Jane Austen in Lizzie Bennet, but I don't think that she qualifies as a Mary Sue because, a Mary Sue is someone where They are universally beloved and incredibly talented at everything. And Lizzie Bennet is neither. Lizzie Bennet is, in many ways, is the opposite of a Mary Sue, in that she is constantly shown to actually be very witty and is talked of as pretty but not like stunning, and people react to her very much like she is a real person, and she is a real person. She's one of the most believable characters in literature, I think.
She's so relatable, because like, compared to Emma, where she was very rich and very manipulative, like, and toying with her friends' lives almost, this is like, in real life there's always people that are like way richer and way better than you at everything. And there are always people who are a bit poorer than you. And like, and she's just really relatable in that respect. She's nice without being sort of obnoxiously, you know, she's relatable, nice but relatable.
Yeah, she's brilliant. And the thing about her is, I feel like every modern woman thinks that she is Lizzie Bennet.
I think I'm Mary. Yeah.
She's brilliant. Obviously, she's brilliant. Austin described her as delightful a creature as ever appeared in print.
Oh.
And I feel like that means that there probably is a lot of Jane Austen in there, because she clearly loves her. But also, I don't think she is Jane Austen, because I would certainly never describe a character I'd based on myself that way.
I suppose we can never really know which of her characters was most similar to her.
No, unless there is a letter that I'm not aware of in which she actually says, "Dear Cassandra, Marianne Dashwood is exactly me," which I would be shocked at. But so, how would you rate Keira Knightley's likability as Lizzie Bennet?
I thought she was quite likeable. I'd give a strong 7.5.
A strong 7.5?
Yeah. What did I give for Emma? Because I felt as if I didn't like her as much. I hope I'm not giving her the same score. I might bump it up to an 8, actually.
I'm going to give her a 9. Because it is between an 8 or a 9 for me. And yeah. I would like to make this show of appreciation towards Keira Knightley as a way of making amends for irrationally disliking her, I guess. Okay, do you know what we have barely talked about this entire podcast?
What?
Mr. Darcy.
Oh, okay. So is this for the category of, what's the exact wording?
Sexiness of leading man.
Sexiness of leading man. I am afraid, for the reasons stated before, he just did not do it for me at all. And I've seen that actor in other things and I thought he was great, but he just, and like the bit where that he makes the first attempt at the proposal and they're in his folly on his grounds and the rain's coming down, it's honestly more like a horror film than a romance. And he completely insults her with this really mean proposal, and he's like, "I love you despite your crude family and despite your rubbish background and your despite my better judgment, I love you." And it's just horrible. And no wonder she rebuffs him. But then I think he did redeem himself towards the end with his kind actions. And the final scene where they propose, just the scenery and the setting, it was so beautiful. It was almost like a Wuthering Heights crossover.
Yeah, but Jess, this isn't sexiness of the scenery. This is sexiness of the leading man. See, I'm interested to hear you say that you thought that the scene with the proposal was like a horror film. Like, I agree. Obviously, it's a dreadful proposal. Like, that's the point of it. It's so bad. It's such a bad proposal. But I honestly think that that's such a sexy scene.
I suppose everyone's different.
I suppose everyone is different.
Oh no, I just felt it was really hurtful and mean and harsh.
I mean, yeah, it is those things, but there's so much chemistry between those two in that scene.
I mean, there's social awkwardness, and then there's just not making any effort to even be civil.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, he is being a bit civil at the start. He's taken aback and deals with it badly, doubles down.
I just felt he was really rude. He was boorish. He was snobbish. I'm going to give him a 4 out of 10.
A 4 out of 10?
Yeah. And I've seen that actor in other things and he's great.
See, I don't find the actor, personally, very attractive.
He's fine. He's all right.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. Oh, do you know what? I know that I went on a bit of a rant about Ewan McGregor's hair last episode. Only last episode. But I'm going to have to do it again. Because what is up with that haircut? It's not Regency and it's not attractive. Someone, do better.
It's just like a bit of a mop top, isn't it? It just flops down.
I think maybe that's why I think that the rain scene is so sexy. It's probably because you can't tell how bad the haircut is.
Yes. Yeah, it's like Oasis or something. It's just flat.
It's so bad.
And while we're talking about that, why on earth is Bingley's hair so tall?
To be fair, I thought that was quite in keeping with the time.
They did have tall hair, but no one else's hair was tall.
No, that's fair. That's like, they have very much made Bingley, like, proper Regency look.
It's almost as if they decided to dial the Regency up or down for certain characters, which doesn't make much sense because it's all set in the Regency era.
Yeah, I did find that a little bit jarring. But with Matthew McFadden or McFadden, anyway, despite the fact that he has bad hair, I think that what he does really, really well is like this yearning. He's always, or at least from after the first couple of scenes, he's always so focused on Elizabeth, and he does this like yearning to kiss her or be near her so well. Like you have this chemistry in that scene with the proposal where they're so mad at each other, but they both still keep looking in each other's eyes and towards each other's lips in a way where it's like, kiss!
Oh, I think I'm just a cold-hearted cynic.
No, I see where you're going with it. It's not a romantic scene, but I think it is a sexy scene. And I think that this Darcy is like, you can see the lust in a way that a lot of Jane Austen adaptations, certainly in the past, have shied away from. But I think is definitely present there in the book. Like, I think, obviously, there's lust there. And I think he does that very well. Like, the bit where she's yelling at him, you know, about how awful he is, and you can just see like this hunger in his eyes where he just like really wants to kiss her. And I feel like this Darcy, if he was horny on Main, he would definitely be posting comments asking like powerful women to step on him. So I think there's definitely a sexiness there. I would not pine over this Darcy, but I would be okay with it if he wanted to pine over me.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm going to give him a 7.
Oh, a 7. Yeah. Ooh, very nice. Is there a time to talk about the weirdly lustful moment with Bingley?
Which one?
So Bingley...
Are you talking about with the dress?
Yeah, he just grabs her, like the fabric of her dress. It almost like he's going to grab like her bum. And then he just grabs the fabric of the dress as she walks in front of him. And it zooms in on his hand.
Yeah, totally. I think that was intended to be like a tender moment. And I feel like if it had been a trailing ribbon, it would have come across as much more tender. But because there's not actually a trailing ribbon, he literally just like grabs some fabric where her bum is.
Costumes let us down again.
It's like, that's come across differently. It looks awkward and inappropriate and...
And Bingley himself, I'd have liked more time to get to know Bingley.
Fair.
As I would the big sister. The big sister, you know.
Jane,
yes.
Let's go for Austen Leigh vibes.
Okay.
Did you feel, as someone who doesn't know a lot about Jane Austen but is aware of Pride and Prejudice as a cultural phenomenon, did you feel like this gave you what you wanted from an Austen adaptation, from an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice?
In terms of the acting and the plot and the scenery, 100% yes. I just feel as if they had the opportunity with their big Hollywood budget to make a real effort with the costumes as well, and they just didn't take that opportunity. And there's a moment, for example, where they go to a fancy ball and one of the characters isn't wearing gloves. And you would have worn gloves because, not just because it shows your wealth, but of course, deodorant and antiperspirant hadn't been invented, and you would be getting really, really sweaty in those hot dance halls. You would be holding lots of other people's hands, touching lots of other people's clothes, and, you know, it would have been really unhygienic and quite clammy and disgusting not to wear gloves. And just little touches like that really let it down. And it's a shame as well, like, for Keira Knightley's actual look, as well as saying, like, that there's things where that are just from no era at all, like the bodice a lot of times has, like, an off-centre fastening that's, like, set on one side, and that's not something that's ever been around apart from modern times. But also, her hair, like, they've done this coiffure, but you can tell that it's a hairpiece and she's actually got short hair because you can see the tiny bits of short hair poking out at the nape of her neck. And that's so obvious. It really shows up, and it's just little things, that little bits of attention to detail like that that really let it down. It would have been so easy to just pin those up or gel them, and they just didn't do it. And so I think with this budget and with this big opportunity, and especially since the American audiences love Jane Austen, the reason that you watch a Jane Austen adaptation is partly for the costumes and the scenery. And, like, if you're not going to do the costumes right, what's the point in doing it at all? Unless you're doing some modern version in space. I mean, it's not even inauthentic. Some of it is just plain drab and just plain unpleasant to look at.
So what would you give it out of 10?
It's a shame because the rest of it is so good.
Well, I guess it depends on how much you think, how big an issue the costumes are for you.
For me, it matters. I might have to give it a 6.
I'm going to give it a 7. Because I think I've already said about the way that they focus on these little moments and these glances and these turns of phrase. I think that is so much of what Austen is to me, and they really understand the importance of it in a way that I think few other adaptations really do linger on that. I think the exaggeration that they do really lets it down for me in terms of Austen-y vibes. I don't feel 100% like I'm watching an Austen adaptation because... Well, I do feel like I'm watching an Austen adaptation, but it doesn't feel like reading an Austen book because it's too exaggerated.
Yeah, I did pick up on that. Yeah, definitely.
And finally, out of 10, how much did you enjoy it?
I did quite enjoy it. Maybe 7? Yeah. It made me feel as if I'd been on a lovely holiday. It really took me out of myself, and I felt very absorbed in it. And even though it was 2 hours long, I kind of didn't notice. And that's always the sign of a good film. But I did feel as if, as I said before, they were trying to fit too much in.
Yeah, I agree that it is a little rushed. It does suffer from the fact that it's a much short, like it's a film trying to condense a novel, a dense novel. Into 2 hours. I'm going to give it an 8 because it's a good film, it's a good adaptation, but I enjoy the aesthetics of it so much. So I think that the scenery, the music, the lighting, the cinematography, it's just beautiful. So I'm going to give it an 8. I actually watched it again this morning, even though I watched it for this recording not that long ago, and it was just what I needed. It was really nice.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's just the tonic.
It was just the tonic. So I'm going to give it an 8, which means that its percentage score is 72, which I think is pretty high.
Oh, okay. Oh, we don't want score creep.
Well, we've only done 2, and they've been 2 strong offerings.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some real howlers out there that'll bring it back down.
Oh, there are. Should we talk about the like extra categories before we pick a new one? Because we might get one of those howlers next time.
Yes.
So if you haven't listened to the podcast before, then you can go and listen to our first episode, probably wherever you found this second one. But if you don't want to do that and you can't be bothered, Jess and I both score the 5 categories you've just heard funniness of the side characters, the sexiness of the leading man, the likability of the leading lady, the Austenly vibes, and the enjoyability of the film. We score each of those out of 10 each to give a combined total of out of 100, and that's its percentage score, because those are the things that I think make a really good Austen adaptation for me. We also score, for the benefit of listeners who may have different criteria, the sexiness of the leading lady, the likability of the leading man, the faithfulness to the book, and the appropriateness for modern sensibilities. So let's just talk a little bit about that. How sexy do you think Keira Knightley is, Jess?
Fairly. Hard to tell when she's wearing a Hessian potato sack.
Well, to be fair, the costuming is a part of it, you know? Like, what someone's wearing is a part of how sexy they are at any given moment. If you think that she's wearing something really unsexy, then that's obviously going to affect how sexy you think the whole situation is. You're not judging Keira Knightley as a person out of 10 or what have you. Giving a set score for this isn't quite so important, but, you know, you're judging the whole presentation of Keira Knightley's Elizabeth Bennet.
Yeah, maybe. Well, she's very intelligent as well, though, very witty. So that'll bump her up to an 8. The two things are conflicting, but she's certainly really, she says it like it is. She's not afraid to speak her mind, and she makes these witty comments, and that's a really good factor. Yeah, an 8.
I really agree. I think that the wittiness of Lizzie and just how cool she is really sexy. I am not attracted to Keira Knightley. I appreciate that she is a beautiful woman. I'm not attracted to her, though. But I think that how sexy Lizzie's personality is more important, and so I'm going to give her a 7. How much did you like Mr. Darcy?
I didn't like him one bit. He was so rude. Is he meant to be rude?
Is that
the point?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of like...
The book is called Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, because he's proud and she's prejudiced. And oh!
And really, if you think about it, she's also proud and he's also prejudiced.
Yes, against her common family.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And then they do a sort of a switcheroo. Oh, that's crazy. I don't know. I just think he was too mean at the start. And it just completely... It's almost like a modern toxic masculinity almost, in that he's just not making any effort, doing any emotional labour to make the situation more bearable. He just leaves that to other people.
But then when Lizzie says to him, you're bad at talking to people because you don't practice, when she's playing the piano, he does then practice. He tries. He invites Mr. Gardner out to fish.
He does invite him out to fish. But should he need someone to tell him that? Or... Like, the fact that he's reached that age, like, how old is he? Like, 35, 6, something like that?
Not quite that old, but, yeah, about 30, I think.
That he's reached that age. I mean, I've done so much character building. I'm almost bearable now. And I'm only 31. And he's still... Like, nobody's told him this before. Like,
apparently he's 28. So he is actually younger than us. Maybe we should cut him some slack.
Okay, but I don't know. Yeah, he still needs... You know, he should have come to that conclusion himself by that point. It's just inconsiderate not to.
That's fair enough. I like Mr. Darcy, but I do think that in this adaptation, you know how we talked about that really abrupt change?
Yeah.
I think that abrupt change just doesn't... It's too abrupt and it doesn't make the switch believable. And so it does feel a bit like, hey mate, if you could so easily act this way all along, why weren't you?
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's what I mean by why didn't he come to that conclusion by himself? Like, if it was so easy for him to change, yeah, why didn't he? I'm gonna have to give him a 4. I mean, I do know that the fact that Darcy is standoffish is, like, meant to be a thing in this novel.
Yes.
I don't know, I'm going to give him a 4. Like, I could not talk to him at a party. If I met him at a real party and he was a real person, I'd just make an excuse and move on.
That's true. He wouldn't be who you'd want to go to the pub with, necessarily.
Like, I wouldn't devote that time and effort to reforming him.
But I do think he really proves that he has a lot of substance to his character.
Yeah, he's got depth. He's not one-dimensional.
I'm going to give him a 6.
Fair enough.
Faithfulness to the book. It is quite faithful to the book.
Ah, cool. Apart from the pig incident.
Yeah, apart from the pig incident. Like, it's the substance of it is pretty well there. It's very exaggerated. There is no reason why Lady Catherine de Bourgh would come to Longbourn in the middle of the night.
Yes!
That was bizarre.
I was wondering about that.
But apart from that, it is quite faithful. I think it's 7 out of 10. Faithful in facts, but not necessarily in spirit all the time. And how much did this line up with your modern sensibilities, Jess?
So, this is what I was really interested about. So, we haven't talked much about the character of Mr. Wickham.
We haven't.
So, he's a real cad, and he and Lydia elope, and it's very heavily implied that they have premarital sex. Oh my gosh.
Yep.
And he also really preys on her because not only is she very young, I believe she's like 15.
Yeah.
But she's also very silly. But I was quite shocked by this because I would have liked a little bit more about Lydia's character development before this happened, because this was quite a shock in the film. And I kind of feel as if they'd have established that Lydia was very silly and very frivolous, it might have made more sense in the plot, because it sort of felt like it was just sort of rushed on the end.
I felt like that was established, but again, I'm coming at it from a different angle in that, of course, I already know that Lydia's so silly.
Yeah, but then also Mr. Wickham, not only does he prey on Lydia, but he also had this affair. He basically seduced Mr. Darcy's, again, underage teen sister for his nefarious aims to get all her money. And I find that very interesting that there's a very big difference between the modern villain and the old-fashioned villain. Because the modern villain, you're often trying to build a sympathetic backstory or at least give them some sort of motivation. But with Mr. Wickham, we don't really get to know him very well. And I feel as if there's not much explanation of why he is the way he is. It's almost like the old-fashioned sensibilities were just, if you're bad, you're bad because the devil's in you, or something like that.
I have to stick up for the original work and for Wickham. Oh God, I can't believe I'm saying that. He is a more fleshed out character in the original work, and the fact that we get to know him so little before we find out he's just an abominable person is a product of the fact that things are rushed over in this film, you know, as we've already talked about. And I think that is a bit of a shame, because I think that reveal loses something, for sure.
Because when we meet him, he's just a normal bloke. It just seems perfectly normal. And then to find out that he's done all that, and you're like, well, who could this man be who could do all those things? I think maybe he was motivated by greed or envy, but it does seem a bit weird that he was given all the opportunities that Mr. Darcy was given, and he just gambled them away.
Oh, well, he wasn't given like all the opportunities. Like, Mr. Darcy inherited a huge estate, and he wasn't dependent on anybody for him getting that. He was always going to get it. Whereas George Wickham was left a job, essentially, in a will.
Oh, I'd love to be left a job. That's a walk in the park for me.
And they are very different situations.
Yeah. But I still think that it's almost like, oh, he's just born bad and he just did gambling because that's the vice of the time, and he gambled away all the money because that's the evil thing.
I think what's interesting about Wickham and what you were talking about in regards to him is that obviously back in the day, back in the Regency day, premarital sex would be such a big deal. It would be so much of what was wrong about that situation. Whereas now, premarital sex, we don't really care, but...
Yeah, even I've done it.
But the situation itself is still awful. We still hate him. Not because he's had a premarital sex, but because he's clearly preying on these vulnerable girls. And he's still awful. He's still just as bad.
Absolutely, if not more so. Another thing which I found was very against modern sensibilities was the attitude to marriage. So when Lydia does get married to Mr. Wickham, even though he's this horrible, horrible man, her mom is delighted just for the sake of the fact that she's married. And it's like she values her daughter being married over her being happy.
Yeah, absolutely. But don't you think that... So I think there's two things that I would say in response to that. First of all, like, that's condemned. She's shown to be really silly. Like, it's shown that she's being ridiculous. She's being really blind.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And so I think that actually this film, and Pride and Prejudice in general, and this film particularly, makes an effort to show marriage as, like, the ideal marriage as being for love rather than for money.
Yeah, it's almost like Lydia's one is the antithesis of Lizzie's one.
Yeah.
Because they're stuck with each other. Like,
yeah.
Mr. Wickham's stuck with a frivolous, silly woman and she's stuck with a evil man.
I think as well there's this, the weight that they put on this little line that's so often missed, where Lizzie chastises Mrs. Bennet for being so caught up in marrying her daughters off. And Mrs. Bennet takes a beat and tells her, like, when you've got five daughters, you tell me what you're worried about. Because, obviously, if her daughters don't get married, they can't support themselves.
Yeah, I suppose women were just a burden on families.
And Charlotte Lucas says it. She says, I'm already a burden to my parents at 27.
Yes, I found that very, very sad that she's a spinster at 27 and she marries the awful Mr. Collins just because he's the only option. Yeah, that's really sad. But she sort of finds a way to be happy by just completely avoiding him all the time.
Yes.
And making him go in the garden.
Yeah. Having her own little room for her particular use.
Yes.
I think that Pride and Prejudice is one of the stories that is easiest to be fine with. You know, easiest to transplant its values into modern life. And I think that this adaptation takes time to just give breathing room to a few beats that really highlight where people are coming from. Just making a point of, like, we're not saying marriage is all that matters for women because we're saying it like we're talking about this as if it matters so much because it does in this context.
Yeah.
Because it's stability, it's safety.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And those things do matter. Of course, a parent is going to worry about that for their children. So I like it. I think it does pretty well.
Another thing I thought about it going against modern sensibilities, this is a bit of a curveball, but I noticed that they bought Mr. Wickham a commission into the army at the end and he was wearing sort of the authentic red coat. So there's quite a dark reason behind why the soldiers at the time were called the red coats. And the red coat, you'd think, like, why would you wear that? It's completely bright and people could see you. But actually, being as warfare was quite close quarters at the time anyway, it didn't matter what colour you wore because you'd be visible.
Of course, everybody can see you.
You're in plain sight. It's only with the invention of the rifle barrel that you could snipe people from afar, but that's a different topic. But yeah, so the reason the coats were red is quite a sad reason. It was to indoctrinate, like, ordinary people, poor people, into becoming soldiers. All military uniforms, the reason they look so dashing, and Mr. Wickham, despite being evil, did look so dashing, was they were deliberately designed to be attractive and glamorous and cool, because that would get people to want to join up.
What, to induce people to become a dashing soldier?
Honest to God, yes.
And I suppose, actually, thinking about it, the way that the Bennets talk about officers, like the way that Mrs. Bennet and Lydia and Kitty are always like, officers. Like,
yeah.
I suppose it goes that way as well, in that it makes the people who aren't going to be turning up to the army value soldiers more highly because now they're sexy.
Well, yeah, the uniforms, as you can see, they're very tight fitted. They're very flatteringly cut. They're very, the leggings and them really show off the men's legs. They're really sexy. They've got this gold and the brass. And the reason it's quite sad is because joining the army is the only way that a lot of people in Britain at the time could ever wear something as dashing and as fancy as that. And particularly the colour red, very few ordinary people could afford the red dye, you know, that bright red colour. And they just couldn't.
So it's basically a temptation to join, like it's a bribe.
Yeah, it's almost a bribe. It's almost indoctrination. Like, Hugo Boss designed the Nazi uniforms.
Yeah.
Like, they actually get designers on board to design deliberately sexy uniforms. I'm not saying the Nazi uniforms are sexy, but, like, they deliberately get designers on board to design these sexy uniforms. So that's why, basically.
Wow.
Yeah, they're deliberately sexy to indoctrinate young men into impressing girls.
Or to indoctrinate young girls into caring about soldiers, when really they're all just cads. Imperialist cads.
Persuading the men in their life that they know to become dashing soldiers. But if you think of the access that people would have had to fine costumes, as you were saying at the start, cloth was so expensive. You know, that's going to be a major motivation.
Yeah. So I think that this film does quite a good job of appealing to a modern audience. It doesn't make any particular pains to, like, update it as a feminist version or, you know, or anything like that.
It shows it as it is.
It shows it as it is. I'm going to go with 7 or 6. I'm going to go 6.5. I don't know.
So possibly by virtue of the fact that I haven't read the book, and it was like a lovely relaxing holiday for me, I'm going to go with a 7.
So I think that that's done pretty well. Really, its only low score is that you did not like Mr. Darcy at all.
Oh, and the costumes thing.
And the costume. Well, the costumes thing bumped it down a few points in Austin Lee vibes and enjoyability, but those were still fairly decent scores.
It's just so horrible. Like, is that meant to be the plot? Such a rude man.
I mean, yes, it is meant to be the plot that he is a rude man.
Okay, fair enough.
I am very interested to know what you think of future Mr. Darcy's, because I'm looking at our spreadsheet now and there are going to be a lot of them.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So for our next outing, I was going to say, but for our next meet, our next recording, what kind of film would you like to watch? So do you want to continue watching a kind of standard adaptation of all 6 novels before we get into any modern adaptations, or are you not that fussed about that?
Oh, I'm not sure about that, because that might get a bit
boring,
samey. Yeah.
Should we go a bit different next time then?
Yeah, what should we watch?
How would you feel about a modern adaptation of Sense and Sensibility?
Yes, what's it called?
From Prada to Nada.
From Prada to Nada?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that any Spanish-speaking listeners are going to be in pain at our pronunciation. But yeah, From Prada to Nada.
They're going to be delighted by my Wolverhampton accent. I can actually speak Spanish. Why am I doing this?
Yeah, but that's what I was going to suggest as our next go.
Yeah, let's do it.
I haven't seen this one yet, so I'm really excited to watch one that I haven't seen before. I've heard quite good things.
Okay, that could be fun.
So let's watch From Prada to Nada. Thank you so much to everybody for listening to this episode. We really enjoyed Pride and Prejudice brackets 2005, and we are really looking forward to From Prada to Nada. So thank you so much, Jess, for joining me again.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
Bye.
Cheerio. Do